Our second case for this morning is United States v. O'Connor. And we are just about ready for you, Mr. Boecker. Is that how you pronounce your name?
It's Boecker, ma'am.
Pardon me?
Boecker.
Boecker. Okay. Oh, okay. So, let's type it here. Boecker. Yes, you may proceed.
May it please the court. My name is Evan Boecker, and my colleague, Kevin O'Keefe, we represent the appellant, Ajri O'Connor, to the Bloom Legal Clinic at Northwestern University, using our 7-Eleven licenses. O'Connor's trial was unreasonably delayed by 3.5 years, a trial that only had one charge and took 4 days, and a trial that was flawed in at least 3 ways. First, before trial, the extensive delay resulted in a violation of her speedy trial rights and her Sixth Amendment rights, requiring dismissal with prejudice.
So, Mr. Boecker, let me put this on the table right away for you. She didn't file a motion to dismiss based on the Speedy Trial Act until December 31st, 2008. And in that motion, the only thing she complains about are things from September 4th, 2008 forward. So it strikes me, first of all, as a practical matter, quite unfair to the district court judge to blame her for not reaching back and looking at potential reasons for exclusion or non-reasons for exclusion for matters not even raised in the motion. And secondly, I'm concerned about, perhaps at a minimum, forfeiture of her right to complain about anything that happened before September 4, 2008.
Well, Your Honor, The Speedy Trial Act is quite clear that the only way that one can waive one's rights to dismissal under the Act is by not filing a motion at all. It specifically says that failure for the defendant to move for dismissal, that's the way that you lose the right. In this case, a motion was filed, and there's a requirement that they support it, and it was supported.
And that's why I used the word forfeiture, for one thing, not the word waiver. And secondly, that language that you just quoted from the statute doesn't say anything about whether you get to complain about speedy trial violations from extensions, you know, in the September 4th order, or whether you just throw a generic motion and maybe you just make one complaint in it, but you actually mean to be complaining about 3.5 years' worth of rulings. That seems to me a rather poor way to run a judicial system.
Well, Your Honor, the Act primarily places the burden upon the courts to determine whether or not a speedy trial has occurred and to ensure that a speedy trial does occur. So,
and what's the judge supposed to do when every time she makes an extension for the ends of justice or for continuity of counsel or investigation, she says, I'm going to give this extension, and the defendant's lawyer says, fine with us, Your Honor?
Well, as you pointed out, Your Honor, the Act only requires that a motion be filed just before the trial date. That's all the Act requires, and in fact, that is the typical system.
I know, but this motion didn't complain about things before September 4th. I agree that she filed a motion, but I'm just wondering whether she's now in a position to complain about extensions of time prior to the first order that she identifies.
Well, yes, Your Honor, she is. I mean, it only requires that a motion be filed, which was done in this case. And additionally, it is the onus of the court to make sure that a speedy trial occurs.
But do you think that the motion would have been enough if she had just filed a motion that said, I move to dismiss this case on grounds of a violation of the Speedy Trial Act, period?
Well, Your Honor, this court in Turner actually upheld something very similar to that. in which Turner made an oral motion, and it was vague. He didn't refer to any specific continuances, and yet the district court and this court reviewed the entire record in order to determine whether or not a Speedy Trial Act violation had occurred.
Well, the critical words you just used were the district court also looked at the whole record, having been alerted to the issue.
Well, in that instance, the district court recognized its duty to review the entire record because the Speedy Trial Act is specific that it says that if 70 days have elapsed, then it shall be dismissed. And so the district court in that case took its responsibilities very seriously and examined them as it was supposed to. In this case, the district court did not examine them, even though they admitted on the day of trial that they had made some mistakes and they didn't really understand the process. She admitted that, well, you know, I've learned something through this motion, I should be more careful in the future, suggesting that she recognized that she had not fulfilled the act throughout and she should have gone back to the record and looked again. I'd also like to point out that a large part of this delay that we're looking at is due to the acts of the court and places where it dropped the ball by simply not providing the reasoning that the Speedy Trial Act requires.
But the judge doesn't need to do that until the motion is filed.
Doesn't need to provide the reasoning?
I think... The judge can expand. I mean, she says ends of justice. All those orders that just get entered and entered and entered refer to the ends of justice. But it's been considered enough if the judge eventually explains, and the judge does go through for the motions that are, or for the orders that are highlighted in the motion and explain why she's extended the time.
Well, what we'd like to point out is that the reasoning is not included throughout, and there's nothing that backs up that reasoning.
So where do you see the obligation to give a contemporaneous, complete explanation every time there's an extension?
Well, it's better for the appellate.
There is no case that says that, is there?
Well, Zedner says that it's preferable that it does do that, Your Honor.
It's different from saying it's mandatory.
That's true, Your Honor. However, by providing the reasoning at the time, it's easier to go back, to go afterwards, if you're not doing contemporaneous reasoning, if you're not doing contemporaneous findings, it's easier to go back afterwards and support those.
Oh, I absolutely agree with you. I mean, the question is, do we dismiss this case, though, because this judge didn't engage in that preferable practice?
I think, in fact, we should, Your Honor, because the reasoning simply isn't there. The court cannot go back after the fact and start putting in the reasoning because it's not in their mind at the time of the decision, as Zedner requires. And going back afterwards and providing that reasoning post hoc, I mean, just from nothing.
I don't know that we know that. I'm sitting here with two former trial judges. Maybe they have a view about whether this completely flees the mind or not, but...
I'm interested in when you, when the government filed its request for a Rule 15 deposition, the trial date was going to be changed. Was there any concern expressed by the defense at that time that this case has taken a long time and we don't want it tried in January as the court put it down in October, advance it 2 weeks from that September trial date, or anything of that nature take place?
Well, Your Honor,
I'll try to answer my own question because I don't think there was anything until this New Year's Eve motion to dismiss for a violation of speedy trial.
Well, Your Honor, it's true that there were no objections, but the Act doesn't require objections throughout the process.
I know that the Act doesn't require it, but sometimes it's nice when a lawyer will alert a judge to a problem. Now, here, this defendant was out on bond, so that's not usually a concern. Defendants would be happy to have their trial delayed indefinitely.
Well, in this case, Your Honor, the court was already on notice. It had mentioned a year and a half into the proceedings that this was a very, very old case. So the court already knew that this was an old case and repeatedly mentioned it throughout the proceedings.
The old case had a lot of defendants and
only at the very beginning, Your Honor. For the latter half, from March 24th on, right, she was the only defendant, and that represents half of the delay that we see here. Additionally, most of the delay that occurred at the beginning was due to a sua sponte order in which the court shifted the trial date from May 15th, the date that everybody could go to a July date, and that forced a continuity of counsel issue, pushing it even further into January. And that sua sponte order was not supported in any way. So here we have an ends of justice, well, they described it as trial preparation, But the court didn't provide any reasoning or explain who needed this trial preparation or that anybody needed any trial preparation. I see that my time is running out. I'm going into the rebuttal time. I'd like to bring up a few other points that we'd like to preserve. O'Connor's case should be dismissed with prejudice because of the extreme delay, which was due primarily to the acts of the government and the court. It may also be dismissed under the Sixth Amendment violation for the same reasons and because of the prejudice that O'Connor experienced at trial due to the faulty memories of the witnesses. And additionally, the government also failed to prove its case by not proving that O'Connor's knowledge and intent, but convicted her through faulty jury instructions that misstated the rules of liability. With no further instructions, I'd like to save the remainder of our time for rebuttal.
All right.
Thank you.
Ms. Greenwald.
Your Honors, the Act, Section 3162, does not merely require the making of a motion. It's the government's position that it also goes on to say that in that motion, the defendant shall have the burden of proof of supporting such motion. And within the scheme of that provision, as well as described in Zedner, the defendant whose interest it is to spot speedy trial violations has an obligation not simply on the eve of trial to file a motion, but to identify what errors they believe were in the calculations. And at the very least, Your Honor, if they're going to file a motion and specify particular areas, they better specify all the areas at which they see issue. Otherwise,
Ms. Greenwald, here's what worries me about the government's position here, and it's really an overarching concern. As I read, granted not quite on point, but as I read both Zedner and the Supreme Court's recent decision in Bloat, what I am getting from that is a strong message from the Supreme Court that it really wants the Speedy Trial Act to be enforced according to its letter. And this case went on and on. Also, actually, what one gets from that is that this is not merely a privilege for defendants. It's something that society has an interest in. It's something that the prosecution has an interest in. And this case comes across to me as one where the system broke down, where the district court is giving very rote, oh, I'm going to throw in the ends of justice, no explanation until the 11th hour. And it does look to me that if we had some reason to look back before that September date identified in this motion, there are far more than 70 days that elapsed that were non-excludable. So I think the government's case is, A, inconsistent with the general thrust of where the Supreme Court's going, and, B, is heavily dependent on our accepting your argument that we don't go further back than September 08.
Well, Your Honor, I totally understand the court's concern with the record in this case, and the government is certainly not holding it up to the court as a model in Speedy Trial Act exclusions.
Improved it even at the time.
However, yeah, absolutely. No.
Says you could have alerted the judge to, you know, the need for somewhat more.
No quarrel with that, Your Honor. However, I would take quarrel with the issue that most of that period of time prior to September 4th, first of all, most of that period of time prior to September 4th, under this court's decision in Napadao, I believe the facts for most of that, not all of it, and I'll get to that in a minute, but for most of it, more than meet the requirements of Napadao. Because in that case, Your Honor, as you'll recall, I know you do, the district court simply said in the interest of justice. You don't have that here. The judge in every instance, bar one, that I'm going to get to in a minute, gave a reason. Interest of justice that tracked the statutory language, reason of justice for trial preparation, for plea negotiations, for continuity of counsel. And then when you go into the record of that status, where that ruling came out of, there are both arguments by context from the arguments by the lawyers, as well as statements and inquiries by the court that support that. So I don't think it's just bare bones interest of justice.
But suppose the judge said, I'm going to extend this trial in the interest of justice and for continuity of counsel, and the judge pushes the trial date forward 11 months. I mean, isn't that unsupported? I mean, why would an 11-month
Well, in this case, I mean, we take it through in detail in the court.
Everybody, it's this case.
In very great specific reference to the trial record. But the one instance that that happened, where it was continued like that, she had time had been excluded through May. She had a status in March. She had changed the trial date in January. She had a status in March. Not one defense lawyer, not one. And this is when she still had nine defendants in the case. Not one came to her and said, Your Honor, we cannot do this new trial date you gave us in July. Not one. They show up at her status on March 17th. They say, we are not available for trial. She says, I don't want to kick this trial a year till you're all available. We need to do some substitution of counsel. This is all on the record cited in our brief. Defense lawyers then say, Your Honor, there's realistic pleas going to happen here. Please put us...
At the very beginning, by December 2006, we're only left with two people.
No, Your Honor. Absolutely. In December of 2006, and the continuances that happened...
2009 trial.
Absolutely. But the continuances that happened there, almost totaling, I think it's 18 months, lie at the feet of the defendant. The defendants...
That's assuming that this is all about defendants, and that's where I come back to Bloat and Zedner and see from the Supreme Court of the United States the notion that the judge had an independent responsibility to move this case.
Absolutely, but she's not even challenging those orders in those 18 months, nor could she, because in those instances, the defendant comes to the court and says, I'm getting a new lawyer, my third one, yes, and I need a continuance. And the judge... You know, and the government was like, we can't get into relationships between retained counsel. So the judge continued it then. Then her co-counsel came in and said, I need more time to prepare. Then the co-counsel came back and said, I'm on trial. The defendant never requested for a severance during any of that period. Then on the eve of the trial, the defense lawyer's father needed spinal surgery. And there was another continuance. She does not challenge that whole 18-month period at all. I think it's 18 to 20 months, and please correct me if I've got the exact number wrong, but it's a substantial period of time that is not challenged at all. And truly, I think we'd be, if had the court denied those requests for continuance, I think we'd be here with a very different issue that I believe would be more tenable, which would be her right to counsel, her right to prepare. And so that whole period of time, when they say that this took 3-4 years, whatever, to get to trial, they're really skipping a large chunk of time in there that they don't even challenge on appeal.
Let me ask you hypothetically, if the judge had granted the motion to dismiss,
and
the judge had dismissed the case without prejudice, could you make any argument that a new indictment would relate back to the 05 indictment?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I'm sorry. Could you make any argument? Let's suppose the judge had granted the motion to dismiss the indictment.
Yes.
But had ordered that the dismissal be without prejudice.
Yes.
Could you make an argument that a new indictment would relate back to the 05 indictment in this case so that you wouldn't have a statute of limitations problem? Would not have a statute of limitations. I mean, the offenses here occurred in 01 and 02.
Yes. Oh, I see. Do you mean to her conduct while she was on bond? I'm sorry, I'm losing. Of course, you know, I think under the statute we wouldn't have a statute of limitations problem. We could reindict the case, as I understand the law.
So you think you could relate it back to the 2005 indictment, which itself was timely for the 2001?
I believe that is the case. I do believe that that's permissible. But I would strongly argue, Your Honors, that especially if you're going to reach these prior to September 4th incidents, that's under a plain error standard. And there is, the 42 days, the government does not quarrel and certainly admits that there was an error as to 42 days when the judge excluded it because of her schedule. That is absolutely plain. However, the government would argue that's 42 days, that's only 42 days, it does not violate the act, and were it to somehow get into a, you know, it's a lot of immovable parts in this appeal, but if were it to get us there, this is not a case where that error should be noticed, because it does not affect, given the overwhelming proof of her guilt, the fairness integrity of the judicial proceeding.
Of course, you're right, of course, that there's a long period of time during which she has no room to complain. But on the other hand, there are significant periods of time that she can point to, and we only need 28 more days, according to what you've just said, because you only have, I mean, the statute is actually a pretty tight statute.
It is. But, Your Honor, again, we only have those 42 days. Should you not find waiver, should you agree to take notice of an error, which we would urge you not to. But really, her complaint, Your Honor, we would argue really come down to the last 10 months. I mean, you know, you can put it in the color of everything that went on before.
So the March 6, 2008 through the trial date.
March 24th, actually.
Or March 24th.
Yes. I mean, that's really, if...
Didn't the last defendant, additional defendant plead out on March
6th? 2 years before, but then that, it was in March of 2006, or December 2006.
No, March
but
of those,
08. March of 08
I'm
is
sorry.
When she's, a lot of people plead out.
Yes.
In December 06.
Yes.
There are two people left, and it's
yes.
March of 08.
Yes.
That leaves her the only one standing.
Yes.
And so I'm just trying to figure out whether your argument is that from March of 08 forward is the only time we should be looking at.
Well, our argument is the only time you should really be looking at is September 4th.
Right.
But to the extent that there's any colorable issue here at all, any colorable one, we would argue it really starts May 1st with the change in that trial date. And
what about the periods of time before that that were excluded based on preparation of pretrial motions and raise a bloat issue?
Oh, the bloat issue really was never raised below, ever. The bloat issue has been raised for the first time on appeal.
But the Supreme Court just decided it.
Absolutely, of course, but that issue has been... Of course, Your Honor. But I'm just saying that in terms of you asking me about September 4th, but if you're asking in the context of bloat,
right.
Bloat at the most, again, finding that there's no waiver and you go back and you're going to take notice, affects 10 days in this case and 10 days only. Because from the only period of time that was excluded solely on Tibble, solely on that and not in the interest of justice for motion preparation, trial preparation, et cetera, you'll find an OR-9 and after Judge Bucklow presides over the case starting on September 2nd and with her, I believe it's OR-47, they're all interest of justice exclusions.
But those
it's
weren't
not
explained.
Solely relying on Tibble.
Those weren't explained, as I understand the record, and ends of justice exclusions have to be explained.
Right. Well, Your Honor, our position is they were explained. Again, you know, are you talking about the earlier decisions back in the beginning of the case?
Yes, to the extent that there were alternative ends of justice
yes.
justifications for the
yes.
exclusions to get
yes.
around the bloat problem.
Yes,
those entries weren't explained.
Oh,
they were minute entries.
They were, Your Honor. Absolutely, positively were explained. And in fact, they don't challenge those proceedings. They do not challenge the exclusion of time from September 2nd, 2005. They do not challenge the exclusion of time from December 27th, 2005. That's when she first had the case with 9 defendants in front of her. They're arguing that there's 10,000s of pages of records that they need more time to prepare for trial, which they asked to be held in May because of their schedules. They asked for trial time to research and brief the motions. Those exclusions of times are not even challenged on appeal, nor could they be. Her record is actually excellent on those. She excludes by making specific reference to the act for both on the record orally and in her minute order for trial preparation, for motion preparation, for continuity of counsel. And under NAPIDO, it is totally supported by the record. And as I say, they do not challenge those. So bloat at the most goes to the magistrate's exclusion of time at the very beginning of the case, which were only 10 days there. Because when he first got the case, he set that motion schedule, and that's those 10 days there. So that would be the maximum bloat would affect this case. Turning to, just in my few remaining seconds probably, to the one issue that it's the government's position is before the court, clearly on the merits, and that is the exclusion of time between September 4th and January 5th. The government would argue that under NAPIDAO, that her ruling certainly on January 5th, if not the earlier one, more than, you know, satisfies the requirements of the Supreme Court, that it was not retroactive reasoning. You cannot look at her record on September 4th and suggest in any way, shape, or form that she continued that trial for any reason other than there was an important witness who could not be on trial. And when she tried to set it on the backup calendar, it was the defense lawyer who said he could not be prepared, he could not be ready for that reason. Just to suggest, based on this record, that Judge Bucklow was retroactively finding reasoning, the record just doesn't support it.
I'm just curious, was that Rule 15 deposition actually...
The Rule 15, it was. That was a separate kind of issue. It all came up at the context of the September 4th proceeding. But the reason that the government asked for the continuance was because of the unavailable witness.
Right. So that deposition then was taken sometime after...
Of a separate witness. The Rule 15 was for a different witness, and yes, her deposition was taken. There were two witnesses at issue. The one that was the Rule 15 deposition, that one was taken after much argument between the parties, and eventually got taken in December. And then there was the woman who'd had the baby, who was local to Chicago, and had a very sick infant, who was also a straw buyer, who was the only witness to that loan, as was both proffered by the government and submitted by affidavit at the time of the judge's ruling. So for all these reasons, Your Honor, the government would respectfully request that you affirm the decision to dismiss.
All right, thank you. I believe we'll have Mr. O'Keefe now.
Good morning. I'd like to address the government's arguments in turn. As an initial matter, we did not include the time for the defendant continuances simply because we were taking a conservative estimate of the includable days from the entire 3.5-year pretrial delay. And really, as a practical matter, if 560 days are not enough to find a speedy trial violation, I'm not sure what would be. Secondly, the government misconstrues what really occurred in Napadel. We have taken into account this court's precedent stating that you can look into the context of the hearing to find the necessary findings. What we have here, though, is little more than the use of magic words to justify these exclusion orders as a as an ongoing practice by the district court, simply going beyond the interests of justice and saying trial preparation, which I think occurred at least a dozen times, is just going one step beyond the, you know, and still failing to meet the actual requirements of the act.
But it's a realistic matter how much you're asking the trial judges to do. They're excluding time. This case was a complex financial case, even by the time it boiled down to Ms. O'Connor. And you have both the transcript where the judge is speaking and you've got the minute order. Now, I think we can all agree you don't have to confine yourself to what she puts down in the minute order. And if people are asking for time for trial preparation, the defendant isn't even objecting, what would we tell the district judges to do?
I think that goes back to the waiver issue, Your Honor, and frankly, we need only to look to Zedner for that answer.
So we have to, all right, so you're writing the opinion. You say to the trial judge, you should have evaluated
the statutory factors as is required by the statute and by Zedner.
And she says, I did, and I thought it was a complex financial case, and so I thought there was more time needed for trial preparation, so that's what I said.
I hesitate to say that that occurred in each instance in this particular case, Your Honor. What we have typically is simply an exclusion order entered on the record, perhaps not even included in the hearing transcript, as occurred on September 4th, simply stating that the ends of justice, time will be excluded under the ends of justice for trial preparation or for the interests of justice. Failing to go beyond that is quite clearly a violation of the act.
Is Ms. Greenwald right when she says that if the continuances are not granted and you're forced to go to trial, some of these other people also, while they want to change counsels, while their lawyers say they need more time, while somebody has surgery, all these reasons, and the judge says, I don't care about these reasons, this is the date it's going to go to trial on this date. Now you go to trial, there's a conviction, you have a whole new case on appeal. That's what she says.
That's correct, right? Your Honor. And it would certainly implicate certain constitutional rights. But the issue is, we have no discussion of those rights that would be implicated in this case. That's, I think, what the ends of justice...
What does that mean?
Well, if, for instance, the delay was necessary, may not have been fallen under one of the specific provisions of the Act, then it should be covered by the catch-all, which is the ends of justice. But because Congress did not wish for that catch-all to essentially swallow the rule, they required specific on-the-record findings as to why both the defendant's and the public's interest in a speedy trial would be validated by that continuance. So if they would have raised a constitutional issue, whether that be counsel or otherwise, that would have been a valid reason. But frankly, that is absent from this case.
So you think it's actually just speculative? I mean, this is an experienced district court judge. She might well have known that if you force people to trial before they're ready, they're going to complain either that they didn't have effective assistance of counsel, or they're going to complain that there was interference. They're going to complain about that ruling, setting the trial date so early that it amounted to an abuse of discretion. This judge knows about that. I mean, does she really have to? Sounds like what you want is a really long opinion every time somebody grants one of these continuances.
We don't dispute with the principles enunciated in Napadow or any of the other, the principles that the exclusions can be justified by context. What we're actually looking for is some actual substance as opposed to just mere plucking of terms from the statute, which is, from all appearances, the pattern and practice of the district court in this case. And really, what the Speedy Trial Act requires is not necessarily fair. I mean, I believe...
That's a little beyond our pay grade, I think. But we're aware that you're also making the constitutional argument. I think your time has expired, if you'd like to wrap up.
Yes. Therefore, for the foregoing reasons, we request that you dismiss the indictment with prejudice or, in the alternative, reverse our conviction. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. And we appreciate the Northwestern Bloom Legal Clinic taking this case on. We appreciate both of your efforts, and thanks as well to the government, of course.
Ms. Schrupp, I hope you give these two law students A's for their performance today.